morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us. What an extraordinary day yesterday. Super Tuesday, and the whole momentum of the presidential race shifts, even with Bernie Sanders' impressive performance in California, where votes are still being counted. But it appears Bernie Sanders will win what's the biggest prize on Super Tuesday in the California primary. But remarkable performance by Joe Biden, including his win in Texas, across multiple southern states, Minnesota as well, and winning big in some states. Virginia, prime example. Joe Biden, with his ongoing support to African American and older voters. Bernie Sanders showing his strong appeal to Latino voters and to younger voters. But looking at the very early results of Super Tuesday yesterday, it appears that the older voters were the ones who turned out in greater numbers than younger voters. And that helped to propel Joe Biden to those big victories that he had in 9 of the 14 primaries yesterday. Here in California, just looking at the results currently, and there's still so much of the vote yet to be counted. Yesterday, Dean Logan, L.A. County Registrar, said he didn't anticipate the bulk of the L.A. County returns until the end of next week. But currently in California, Bernie Sanders with 34%, Joe Biden 25%, and below the 15 percentage point threshold for delegates, Michael Bloomberg and Elizabeth Warren. As you probably know, Michael Bloomberg dropped out about 3 hours ago and has put his support behind Joe Biden. We'll talk about what that could mean for Biden beefing up his campaign, which has been criticized for organizational problems and a lack of money. Proposition 13 in California, which would have put a bond measure in place going to local school districts, it is trailing significantly, only 44% of voters supporting it. And in a couple of big congressional races, the North L.A. County race to replace Katie Hill, who resigned from Congress. There, it appears Christy Smith, the Democrat, Mike Garcia, the Republican, will likely face off in November. And in the 50th congressional district, where Duncan Hunter pled guilty to criminal charges for how he used his campaign funds for personal expenses, there, Democrat Amar Kampanajar with 34%, currently Republican Daryl Issa, former member of Congress in a neighboring district, 25%, and Republican talk show host Carl DeMaio with 21%. We'll get into the L.A. County races, district attorney, where Jackie Lacey, the incumbent, is trying to win it outright. In this election, she holds 51% of the vote, but there's still so much to be counted. It's unclear if she's going to be able to do that or have to face a runoff with George Gascón. But we'll get into those races momentarily. First, let me introduce our panelists to talk about the results. Pete Peterson is the dean of Pepperdine University School of Public Policy and senior fellow at Pepperdine's Davenport Institute. Dean Peterson, good to have you with us again. You've been watching a lot of elections, as I have over the years. I can't think of anything comparable to the momentum shift we saw from Joe Biden yesterday. Can you?
I can't either, Larry, and great to be with you. The word is Jomentum, and certainly we've seen an incredible change of events here just in the last 72 hours. As former Vice President Biden says himself, that campaign was dead a week ago, and here we are with him standing with a delegate lead and heading into a couple more major Tuesday primary elections coming up in the following Tuesdays that seem to bode well for him in the future.
One of the things that has to be causing concern among many for the Sanders campaign is they've been making the argument that Sanders doesn't have a limited ceiling, that he has the ability to appeal to working class voters throughout the country, that he's not a young voter coastal phenomenon. And looking at Joe Biden's performance, in some cases dominating in southern states, that's got to be a significant pushback to that argument about Sanders' ability to get those voters.
That's true, Larry. And if you look back at 2016, I was just looking back at the primary election results back in the last 16 election cycle. They're almost identical when you're matching up. Then, of course, it was Secretary Clinton and Sanders. When you look at those southern states, Sanders didn't just lose to Clinton. He was completely dominated. And when you look at the other areas of the map, yes, Sanders won California this time around. He lost it back in 16. But the map is eerily similar between 16 and 20. So for his campaign to argue that it really is, he's really a national candidate, it wasn't true in 16, and it seems to be repeating itself again here in 20.
Also joining us from UCLA, founding executive director of the think tank Latino Policy and Politics Initiative, also practicing civil rights, attorney and policy advisor Sonia Diaz. Thank you so much for being with us. Your thoughts, particularly about the Latino vote here, where Bernie Sanders continued to show strong appeal.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Larry. You know, the Latino vote is really important, and what we saw yesterday is increased in turnout, which is really integral to any success, particularly for the Democratic Party. We also saw, as you just mentioned, overwhelming support for Senator Sanders. That said, I think the takeaway from Super Tuesday is that the entire presidential primary shifted with Nevada and was cemented in South Carolina. So VP Biden really owes a lot to Representative Clyburn, and it'll be Black and Latino voters essentially deciding the outcome of this Democratic contest. Those are the two front runners, and those are propelled by voters of color.
Well, and also propelled by the particular age demographics. It's so interesting to see how the Black voting is unfolding, with African American and older voters dominantly choosing Biden, and Latino and younger voters equally or perhaps even more dominantly choosing Bernie Sanders. And Sonia Diaz, I can't think of such distinctly drawn lines in recent primaries. Can you?
No, but I do want to say that Latino and Black voters are responding to the campaigns that targeted and invested in them. So we've known through national polls that VP Biden has garnered and continues to garner Black voter support, and that is occurring across the country, particularly in the South. For Latinos, there's been a lot of research out of my shop here at UCLA's LPPI about the support that Senator Sanders has amongst the Latino community. I do want to share that there's no evidence that Blacks and Latinos are voting against each other. And in fact, national polls show that for both Blacks and Latino voters, Biden and Sanders are their top two choices.
Okay. But for their top choice, I don't know if voting against each other is the right way of putting it, but they're making distinctly different choices for their number one pick.
Yeah, and I want to go back to targeted investment. So one of the things that was clear out of Iowa and then Nevada is the role that Latinos have played as a center constituency for Senator Sanders' campaign. And this is holistic investment in terms of hiring locally, having bilingual mailers, opening field offices in predominantly Latino communities. We saw support for Sanders again from the Latino community overwhelmingly in Texas and in California. That said, Biden has retained high favorability with Black voters. And we see a lot of Black surrogates who have endorsed and had endorsed VP Biden early on in the campaign. And then with Clyburn's last-minute endorsement before South Carolina, really cemented his capacity to be the predominant favorite for Black Americans. And I think that this is really not about Black or Latinos exercising differential choices. They both support these two candidates, but I do think that we can look at targeted investment and the ways in which campaigns are investing in voters of color differently.
So you don't think it's ideology? You don't think the significant distance between the two candidates, that ideology is driving that voting?
Well, one of the things that I think is really important is always looking at the data. So for Latino voters, the things that are most important are affordable health care, economic opportunity, increasing jobs, dealing with racism. Those are no different than the issues that other Democratic Americans, irrespective of race ethnicity, identify as their top issues going into 2020. In terms of ideology, I think there's a lot in the literature about the role of black voters as a pragmatic voting bloc. I also think, to your point about age, there are differences. Black Americans are older than Latino Americans and Asian Americans, so there is a generational distinction there that will likely yield some changes for the elections ahead.
We're talking with Sonia Diaz, who is the founding executive director of Latino Policy and Initiatives at UCLA. Also with us, Chapman University economics and law professor Tom Campbell, a former member of Congress, also former California state senator, and he was director of the State Department of Finance under Governor Schwarzenegger. He was a Republican office holder and has since left the Republican Party. You're no party preference currently. Is that right, Professor Campbell?
I'm actually founding the Common Sense Party. We are at 20,000, and when we hit 67,000, we'll be an officially recognized party in the state of California.
All right, very good. So, Professor, I'm interested in turnout here because it appears, and you know, we don't know California yet because so much came in at the end with those long lines at the polling locations. We're still trying to figure out the tally here, but it appears that older voters really came out across the country, and that we did not see the surge in younger voters that many had anticipated. Your thoughts on that?
I think turnout is going to be driven by ground game, by organization. And the money was with Bloomberg, but Vice President Biden had the victory without much of a ground game. So I believe what you saw was an artifact of the money and the momentum being in two different places. In that regard, therefore, it's fascinating that former Mayor Bloomberg not only endorsed Vice President Biden, but pledged to use his ground game, his organization, to the benefit of former Vice President Biden. So if turnout is driven by shoe leather, folks well organized with precinct lists and names for follow-up, the so-called absentee ballot chase operations, then Biden's support by Bloomberg is going to be quite a significant change in stimulating turnout, and particularly to the benefit of Vice President Biden.
We're talking with Tom Campbell of Chapman University, Pete Peterson of Pepperdine, and Sonia Diaz at UCLA. If you have questions for our analysts, things you'd like clarified, and again, because California is still so undecided, we can't necessarily answer all of your questions definitively, but if you have questions about what happened yesterday during Super Tuesday in the California primary, call us now at 866-893-KPECC. That's 866-893-5722. Also, if you have a particular piece of analysis, something that really stood out to you that you think came into play yesterday, I'd like to hear from it. And not necessarily touting your candidate. That's less interesting than if you have a point of analysis about what you saw yesterday that you'd like to share. We'd love to hear from it. We have so many very bright and analytical listeners. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Apparently on social media yesterday, there was a lot of criticism from Sanders supporters for Elizabeth Warren not dropping out earlier as Senator Klobuchar and Mayor Pete dropped out through their support to Biden. And those Sanders supporters saying Warren should have done the same thing. Sonia Diaz, your response to that criticism that had she done that, that could have helped Sanders in some of the states he lost.
Yeah, I think that that's a valid point. That said, it's been clear that Biden and Sanders are the front runners. Unfortunately, Senator Warren came in third place in her home state of Massachusetts. So unclear how much she's taken away in terms of delegates in this race, this heated race from Senator Sanders. But I like to say that I'm never going to tell a woman to drop out of a race.
Pete Peterson, your thoughts. If Elizabeth Warren chooses to drop out, and given her difficult showing, she's got to be contemplating that, we would assume, how much does that help Sanders next Tuesday?
Well, it's very possible it could help next Tuesday. There are a couple states where Sanders won, even back in 16, that it will be repeating like Michigan. You look at Washington State as well, Idaho. These are states that Sanders will probably win anyway, but with Warren out of the race, drawing on some of those same voters, I don't think there's much doubt that that would further help Sanders. But of course, the most helpful thing would have been for her to drop out when the so-called more moderate Democrats all dropped out, throwing their support to Biden. I don't think there's any doubt that the Democratic Party stepped in and applied some serious pressure on Buttigieg and Klobuchar to not only drop out, but to immediately throw their support to Biden. That certainly helped him, last night.
Well, and in that event in Dallas that happened the night that they dropped out and threw their support to Joe Biden, I believe it was Monday night, they did it with such enthusiasm. Klobuchar almost had to, Joe Biden almost had to take her off the stage. She was so enthusiastic. And that probably had to help, too, that people felt it was not pro forma.
Well, and that's the other part of it, right? I'd love to see who bought those plane tickets, by the way, for Buttigieg. looking at now at the Warren side of the equation, it's not just whether she drops out, but how vociferously she comes out in support of Sanders, which would seem to be where the logical landing place for her support would be. It's really a two-parter. And so it'll be interesting to see what transpires here in the next couple of days.
All right. Coming up next hour on Air Talk, we're going to look at the voting experience in Southern California. Things generally apparently went smoothly in Orange County. One of the exceptions, UC Irvine, where so many students came out late in the day that they were a bit overwhelmed there. But in Los Angeles County, there were long waits at many different locations, particularly as Super Tuesday went on. So we'll talk about that next hour. Right now, I'm asking if you'd like to provide some analysis on what happened yesterday in the 14 states holding Super Tuesday primaries, or you have questions for our three analysts with us right now. We're at 866-893-KPCC. Back in 1 minute on Air Talk. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. We're joined by political analyst Sonia Diaz of UCLA, Tom Campbell of Chapman University in Orange, and Pete Peterson of Pepperdine University in Malibu. Our line's open for you at 866-893-KPCC. We also have our Air Talk Facebook page. You can tweet at Air Talk and let us know. Dimitri writing on the Air Talk Facebook page, whoever the geniuses were that redesigned the voting process, they consolidated numerous precinct locations into voting centers without increasing the number of machines. I stood in line for 3.5 hours at the Beverly Hilton, where there were only 5 machines for hundreds of voters. Outrageous. That's Dimitri. And next hour, we're going to get into that issue of the challenges in L.A. County particularly. It was interesting because Orange County also introduced the vote centers, and they didn't seem to have the same degree of problem. Now, one of the differences, as our politics reporter Libby Dankman pointed out yesterday, is Orange County sent everybody, every registered voter, a vote-by-mail ballot. They obviously weren't obligated to use it, but it was there. It was convenient. They could fill it out, drop it in the mailbox, return it to a vote center or drop-off location, and avoid having to vote on site. In Los Angeles County, you had to request a vote-by-mail ballot. But one of the things I want to ask listeners next hour is, if you voted early, did you end up regretting it because of the dropouts that occurred? Or if you voted on the day of, next time, are you going to choose to vote by mail to avoid any complications and long waits at the vote centers? 866-893-KPECC. John in Pasadena says, I'm a Warren supporter. And I think the reason she isn't going to drop out is because she's felt insulted by Bernie Sanders over the last couple of months as his base has gone vitriolic online. I think that makes her dig in her heels. Sonia Diaz, UCLA, do you think that that sort of personal offense could lead her to hold out?
No, because Senator Sanders and Senator Warren sit in the U.S. Senate together, and they are focused on one thing, defeating Trump and taking back Congress. So I know that Senator Warren has such a strong focus on realigning our country and dealing with the absurd policies coming out of Washington, that these personal offenses that are typical of any presidential campaign are not going to stand in the way. What I will say, and I think is important, is Bloomberg endorsing Biden may support Warren staying in the race a little longer.
Liam in University Park says, would Warren supporters go to Bernie? I've personally found they're less ideologically progressive than just personally fans of Warren. And Kathy writes on the AirTalk Facebook page, I think the assumption Warren supporters will automatically support Bernie is not necessarily true. Many of Warren's support came from highly educated white women, and many of these may prefer Biden to Sanders, figuring he's more likely to beat Trump. Tom Campbell, what do you think of those comments?
I think they're right. The result of the primary yesterday was a clear move towards the center among the Democratic electorate. There were NPP voters as well, no party preference voters as well in California, who probably cast a lot of votes for Bloomberg, might have cast a lot of votes for Biden as well. But the movement, if you add Biden and Bloomberg together in California, outstripped Sanders by 15 points. And then nationally, obviously, the move is towards the center on the Democratic side. So as Senator Warren's supporters are redistributed, I don't think you can ignore the overall attractiveness of a movement more towards the center. I define the center as the traditional Democratic coalition President Obama was able to put together with Vice President Biden, and which Vice President Biden invokes regularly and to his success.
Sonia Diaz, your thoughts about white women particularly and where they might go, those that have supported Elizabeth Warren should she drop out?
Yeah, we know that while some white progressives and white moderates might oppose each other in terms of Sanders and Biden, it's clear that there are some surrogates that are in alignment both in the Warren and Sanders camp that seem to coalesce around each other that may be pivotal for white females. I always want to harken back to 2016 when white college-educated voters, including women, overwhelmingly supported President Trump. So the tactical issue here for the Democratic Party is either persuading those voters to support the candidate come November and or doing what we've seen Biden and Sanders do, which is expand the electorate. And so going into the Southwest and Southern states and really thinking through how you can tactically engage Black voters, Latino voters, and Asian American voters for the success of your campaign, both at top of ticket and down ticket.
Sonia, do you have any data on Texas, what happened yesterday? Because with its significant Latino electorate and progressive strongholds around the capital of Austin, the thought was that Bernie Sanders was going to take Texas. So have you been able to look at Latino voters in the state to see if they're proving to be more moderate than Latino California voters?
Yeah, that was the thing I was most excited about for Super Tuesday, was seeing the ways in which the Latino electorate differed in terms of California and Texas. There was something that the polls alluded to, which is that in California, Latino voters overwhelmingly supported Sanders, but their next person was VP Biden. This was an opposite to polling in Texas, which showed Latino registered voters overwhelmingly supporting Senator Sanders, but then followed by Bloomberg and then Biden. What our research at UCLA's Latino Policy and Politics Initiatives found is that Latino voters in Texas overwhelmingly supported Sanders, but there was a stark difference in terms of age. We did see that in Texas, older Latinos voted for Biden, while younger Latinos ages 30 to 44 voted for Sanders. Now, for Black voters in Texas, and this is important, right, because Black voters and Latino voters are really deciding this primary contest. So young Black voters, 18 to 29, coalesced around Biden, but all other Black voters, especially old voters, supported the VP. So Texas's main takeaways, Bloomberg was able to get some votes there in a way that he was not able to in California. We do have moderate Latinos who are going to go with someone that has name recognition and that they trust, and that's VP Biden. That said, Sanders' ground game and his investment in the Latino electorate meant that he's going to take away a handful of delegates from these two huge super states.
Is Texas's Latino population somewhat older than California's? I was wondering if that was part of the difference.
No. So both are border states. Both have generationally remarkable Latino communities, but there's also an influx of immigration and immigrants given the proximity to the Mexico border. And then,
so median age is about the same between the two states. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay, great. All right. Let's see. We have also Jenna in San Francisco's Hayes Valley says, I feel like at this point the country is just too afraid of socialism, and that is why Biden is asserting himself over Sanders. In Pete Peterson of Pepperdine, do you think that came into play, that Democratic voters faced with Sanders' democratic socialism, that label hurt him?
Well, it certainly came out in the last couple of debates, the one leading up to Nevada and South Carolina. Some of his views on Sanders' views on Cuba and just more broadly on socialist policies, I think that became more apparent. But you can't say enough about the importance of South Carolina. Many voters, especially in primaries, are going to make decisions based on the candidate who they think they can win. And certainly through the first caucus and primaries, where Biden performed so poorly, in some ways that kind of fed on itself, where you're not going to win if it's not believed that you can win. And with the firewall there, with Representative Clyburn, as was mentioned before, getting out in front and supporting and endorsing the Biden campaign, the fact that he won in such a dominant fashion really does create that momentum for voters who are saying to themselves, is my vote even going to matter if I vote for somebody like Biden, given what happened? Well, now it does matter, and that is something that really does feed on itself, especially in a primary season where the primaries are iterative. They build on one another.
We're hearing from several Elizabeth Warren supporters who are taking issue with the fact that her supporters would necessarily go to Bernie Sanders. Cheryl in Anaheim sort of captures this in her post. I'm a Warren fan who fits the demographic of her supporters, but if I throw my support to Biden, it won't be because he has a better chance of beating Trump. I'm not at all sure of that. In the face of the uncertainty, if I support Biden from here on in, it'll be because Bernie is divisive and shows no interest in not being so. In terms of the politics, I'm certainly closer to him than to Biden. I mean, that's an interesting point that she's making, Tom Campbell. This is sort of the personality side of the politics, and Sanders rubbing some of the Warren supporters the wrong way. How deep do you think that goes?
Very deep, and very good insight by the participant who posted that comment. I think personality is huge. How did Vice President Biden do so well yesterday? We know it wasn't because he spent a lot of money, and we know it wasn't because he had a substantial number of volunteers working precincts. Rather, it was a persona, which he then reinforced in his victory speech last night, and certainly overwhelmingly in South Carolina. What Vice President Biden was saying is, we are better than this. We are Americans all. We're Democrats all, first of all, because he has to win the Democratic primary. But he was not derisive. He was inclusive. Now, on the side of Senator Sanders, I don't say that he was derisive. I do not say that. But he does not run from the socialist label at all. And when pressed on his support for governments in Nicaragua, Cuba, Venezuela, even back to good things he said about the Soviet Union, he very calmly but strongly reasserted his belief in those statements, as opposed to perhaps what a person less known for being consistent might have said, well, I was young and I've changed my mind. No. So Senator Sanders' great strength is his consistency, and the difficulty is also there in his consistency. And one last point, if I could, addressing the calendar, March 10th, next Tuesday, Michigan, Mississippi, Missouri. I just ask, are those states' Democratic voters going to be affected by the Democratic socialist label, which Senator Sanders happily carries into those states? Michigan, heavy labor representation, Mississippi and Missouri, some of the same demographics that helped Vice President Biden, so forth. I think the socialist label, which the senator embraces, is going to be a substantial negative in the states coming up 1 week from today.
I'd like to hear from Air Talk listeners, in particular Bernie Sanders supporters. And again, it appears Bernie Sanders is going to get the majority of the delegates that are up here in California, but that overall Joe Biden is going to come away with Super Tuesday with more delegates than Sanders. So if you were advising your man, if you're advising Bernie Sanders, what would you encourage him to do to try and improve his performance next Tuesday? Would you just urge him to hold the course you think that people will come around? Or would you urge him in any way to change his message going into those primaries next Tuesday? If you're a Sanders supporter, what would you be advising him to do to try and improve his performance next week? 866-893-KPECC. And then coming up on March 17th, we've got big states of Florida, Illinois, Ohio, Arizona. So the stakes very big in the coming 2 weeks with those primaries as well. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. So much more to talk about with our analysts. We'll get right to it in just 90 seconds. The day after Super Tuesday and the California primary, we're talking about the results and the presidential election, where we stand going into the next big primaries next Tuesday and the following Tuesday, March 17th. We're talking with our guest analysts, Sonia Diaz of UCLA, Pete Peterson of Pepperdine, and Tom Campbell of Chapman University. Jennifer in Altadena, your question for our guests.
I'm curious about Biden voters versus Bernie voters, and this is a bit of a generalization, but I see Biden voters, potentially following Bernie if Bernie becomes the Democratic nominee. I'm curious if Bernie voters in general would do the same if Biden becomes the nominee.
Sonia Diaz, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what we're on the phone about right now, and that's where the pundits are, and I think that sentiment is a big reason why people dropped out of the race at the 11th hour right prior to Super Tuesday, including before their own states ran. I think there's a big push by the establishment, if I may, to support VP Biden because they feel like he has the best shot to win in a general election. I want to say, though, that I think the 2020 contest is really important for the following frame. One, are we going to persuade white voters, including college-educated voters, to not vote for Trump again come November? Or are we going to expand the electorate and put the resources necessary to engage voters who either are being suppressed because of where they reside and their draconian policies? Or are we going to really think through how we get young folks ready to cast a meaningful ballot? Because the White House is paramount, but so are down-ballot races, knowing that we're going to go into redistricting next year.
But it would appear, at least, that surge of young voters didn't happen in most of these primary states yesterday. So is that just a fundamental challenge, getting young people to turn out to match what older voters do with consistency?
Yeah, Larry, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, young Americans don't vote at the same level as older Americans, and that is historical, but there is ways to transform that given the dimensions of the new electorate. So I'm thinking about Asian Americans and Latinos in particular, who are the fastest growing demographic groups in this country, certainly have been in California. There's a huge opportunity, and we saw it in 2018. The fact that Orange County in the 2018 midterms was no longer red and universally supported Democratic candidates. Now, there's a big potential in return on investment for either party if they want to outreach to these voters, and that means young voters.
All right. We're talking with Sonia Diaz of UCLA. Let's take another listener call from Alex in Anaheim. I understand you support Bernie Sanders. How do you think he could refocus his message if you think he should do so?
I think he really needs to make his message more for his Americans for all and humans for all instead of, you know, socialist message. I think people really need to understand that he wants to help everybody and not specifically any political party or whatever, you know, your main focus is on, is just helping people.
All right. So kind of a more personal message. Pete Peterson, do you think that would have a chance of connecting, or does the revolutionary nature of his political positions make that difficult?
Well, I think what we heard in Senator Sanders' speech last night in Vermont, after he won that primary, was that he doesn't appear ready to play nicely. He certainly seems to be committed to the platform that he's put together, which, of course, includes Medicare for All and a Green New Deal, other fairly radical proposals. But he doesn't seem like he's going to be stepping away from them. And, of course, every step he takes away from the policy proposals themselves, trying to draw in what might be considered more center-left voters, is kind of a give and a take, right? I mean, he has built his campaign, as Tom said before, on authenticity, and he has really staked out who he is over decades. And so this is really a trying time for his campaign, but any watering down of his policy proposals or message, and he certainly can't water down his history, will be seen as inauthentic and may do him more harm.
Let's talk with Lewis in Riverside. Lewis, good to have you with us. Your thoughts about what we saw yesterday?
Very interesting. I was somewhat surprised. I'm a veteran of the civil rights movement in Mississippi and Alabama. And the strategic mistake that Bernie and his campaign made in the South, he's lost all the southern states, you might notice, was one. Number one, he failed to attend the Selma Memorial in Selma, Alabama. That was very symbolic and very real to the African-American community in the South and nationally. Number two, he did not have adequate resources in those states like Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, and even in South Carolina until very much too late. He had 5 years to actually build a ground game in those states, and he did not. It's not that he didn't have supporters among the African-American community. He just didn't understand the political culture of those states, and he still doesn't. The third thing, too, is that Biden had the Obama aura still going for him, and he was an underdog. The African-American community loves underdogs. We've always been underdogs for four centuries.
That's a really interesting point, Lewis. I hadn't even thought of that, but you think that's one of the keys.
Those are the three keys, I think, why he lost the South. And unfortunately, that's going to follow him into the North, industrial North, because the African-American voters in the South and in the West, I mean, in the North and in the West, take their cue from the South. And the Michigan vote, he's going to lose to Biden. And the other key states, he's going to lose simply because of the wave that has, you know, been produced in this Super Tuesday runoff.
Lewis, I appreciate it. See, I love our listeners' ability to analyze, because I hadn't heard anyone say that before about African-Americans feeling a connection to the underdog because of their place historically in America, and that Joe Biden, with, of course, his Obama connections and going into South Carolina, being on the ropes as he was, that it enabled African American voters there to exert power in that and to change the trajectory of the primary process. Pete Peterson, your thoughts about that?
No, I think that's a very provocative thought and certainly rings true and has definitely been a message that Biden has been propounding following South Carolina, and certainly his talk last night in Los Angeles has been one about being the underdog. And that is a very compelling message. I didn't understand its particular relevance to the African American community, but it certainly does make sense. More broadly, I think that when he heads to some of those other states, and of course, while last night was Super Tuesday, the next two Tuesdays are very important, the 10th and the 17th. There are major states. Next week, we're looking at, as I said before, Michigan and Washington State, Mississippi, Missouri. And then the following Tuesday, we've got Arizona, Florida, Illinois, and Ohio. And we should know really where we are in delegates in the next couple weeks. You know, those are a lot of big states that are going to be tough for Sanders to perform in, especially when you look out a couple weeks at Florida and Ohio, where he did not do well back in 2016.
Charles in Santa Monica says, I'd like to see Bernie make a distinction about billionaires themselves, not necessarily being immoral, but the system that enabled them to make their money ends up with immoral results. We have John in Pomona says, I'm a Bernie Sanders supporter. It's important for him to not abandon his consistency, even in Mississippi. He needs to explain why his positions make him the better choice than Trump. He needs to message better in his campaign. That's John in Pomona. Adriana writes on the Air Talk page, Bernie Sanders is my candidate, and I am advising him run directly against Trump, never mind Joe Biden. You can share your comments on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. I want to thank our panelists who've been with us, Pete Peterson, Pepperdine University, Sonia Diaz, UCLA, and Tom Campbell, Chapman University. Coming up, KPCC politics reporter Libby Dankman with me. We'll talk about the local election results in Southern California and about the challenges at polling locations known as vote centers throughout LA County. We'll be back in 1 minute. So good to have you with us on Air Talk. It's, of course, the day after the California primary and Super Tuesday, where 14 states went to the polls. We're talking about the results and also what's up in the air, which includes Los Angeles County results. Where we stand right now, with still much more of the vote to be counted, LA County District Attorney Jackie Lacey with 51% of the vote. She's barely holding off a November runoff election, but still well ahead of challengers George Gascon with 27% and Rachel Rossi with 22%. But if you combined their two percentages, they'd be neck and neck with Jackie Lacey. So obviously the DA hoping that she can hold on and avoid having to go against Gascon in a November runoff. For the LA County Board of Supervisors, District 2, South and Southwestern LA County, Herb Wesson with 32% currently, State Senator Holly Mitchell with 26%. Those two are going to face off, it would appear, in November. We have Measure R, which has to do with civilian oversight of the Sheriff's Department in LA County, easily winning with 71% of the vote currently. And the special tax for fire protection in areas served by the LA County Fire Department isn't meeting the two-thirds threshold it needs to pass. LA City Council race is District 4. It's at this point looking like a runoff between incumbent David Rue and Nithya Raman, who's challenging him. Rue with just 47%. He has to get over that 50% if he's going to win it outright. In District 10, the open seat that Herb Wesson left, where he's running for Board of Supervisors, Mark Ridley Thomas, a former supervisor termed out, leading with 47%, but he's not at that 50% threshold. Grace Yu at 25% trailing him. At this point, if it ends this way, the two would face each other in November. District 12, L.A. City Council, John Lee at 53%. He's holding on to try and avoid a runoff. And Kevin De Leon, similarly, in the 14th district there, where that's an open seat. He's got 54%, leading a large pack of other folks there. His name recognition obviously helping him significantly trying to hold off a runoff election. KPCC politics reporter Libby Dankman joining us. Libby, thanks so much. Let's talk about the challenges at vote centers in Los Angeles County. The lines were extremely long. Do you know what time they finally cleared at some of those locations?
You know, there was a television crew in Toluca Lake 3 hours after polls were supposed to close, Larry, so 11 p.m., and folks were still in line there. We did get reports. The L.A. Times talked to some voters at one center who unfortunately had the doors closed on them after 8 p.m., even though they were in line and were unfortunately unable to vote, dozens of people there, because there wasn't the right training at that polling place to let folks know that per California law, you have to let people vote if they're in line by 8 p.m. But, I mean, significant delays and lines, and mostly, according to the registrar, due to technical issues.
Coming up in the next hour, I'd like to hear from those of you who worked the polls yesterday. What kind of training did you get? Did you have a handbook that laid all of this out, including the fact that if there are people in line at 8 o'clock, you are not to close the vote center? What about in the case of paper jams? Was it explained how, with the vote machines, the ballot marking devices, what you're supposed to do? I'd like to hear from you. If you worked at the polls, this will be for our next hour conversation. What was the extent of training that you received, and how much did it seem that your fellow poll workers absorbed that information? Were you tested on the information as a part of the training? I'd like to hear more about it. We're at 866-893-KPECC. That's 866-893-5722. Libby, have you been able to get any insight on the extent of training?
We know that there were mandatory day-long trainings for folks who decided to become poll workers. The amount that folks were comfortable with the technology, especially the check-in tablets that would access the e-poll books, that was inconsistent. I heard from poll workers who said a lot of folks who work in these election centers, the vote centers, you know, they're older folks who are able to spend the time all day long, or in this case, in a 10-day voting period, helping their neighbors vote. And introducing technology like this, not everyone was comfortable with it. But there were also just a lot of new rules this time around, Larry. The same-day voter registration, for example, a lot of folks were confused about the no party preference voters' ability to request a Democratic ballot. You know, all sorts of wrenches that were thrown in to make processing voters a little bit longer, the time that it took to do that. And on top of technology issues, including connectivity with those e-poll books and the ballot marking devices apparently having various paper jams and technical issues that took them out of commission, it all combined to, you know, have folks waiting for far too long. And Dean Logan, the registrar, the county supervisors, they all agree that this has to be investigated, and we have to get to the bottom of what happened.
With all of the machines that ended up out of order yesterday, were most of those cases of paper jams, or were there other issues that people have identified?
We need to figure that out. That's part of this forensic analysis that we need to do here, because the paper jams were the most commonly cited reason, but it's not clear how widespread those were. Sometimes the vote machines you know, arrived at the center and workers were not able to turn those on, it might not have been an issue with the device. It might have been an issue with passwords or, you know, the codes that were needed to actually turn those machines on or get them booted up again if they were turned off. So, you know, with the new system and folks not being entirely comfortable with it, it's not always clear, you know, what is something that should be easily fixed or what is something that is fundamentally wrong with the technology. All of that needs to be investigated.
Yeah, so much to look at. And again, this was such a wholesale change in how the election was carried out in Los Angeles County. New machines, new locations, new training for those working at the vote centers, new rules under which voters were operating in this primary. There was just an awful lot for people to have to deal with at every single level in this. And Libby, we'll look forward to your continuing reporting on this as we try to better understand what went on in these cases. And Bernie Sanders, of course, his campaign filing that court action last night, trying to get the polls to stay open until late last night across the board. That didn't happen, but most of the polling locations with lines did stay open until late. Libby, thanks very much.
Thanks, Larry.
Libby Denkman, KPCC politics reporter, working overtime. She's here late, she's here early, and she's going to be with us throughout the course of the days to come, including our very special Friday program, live, our 10 o'clock hour of Air Talk from the Crawford Family Forum. Please come down and join us. We've got an all-star panel of diverse analysts who are going to be taking a look at Super Tuesday and the California primary results and weighing in. You can RSVP kpecc.org/in-person. I look forward to seeing you Friday morning.